Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. I'm pleased to announce that we have a bar admission ceremony this morning, and it involves some particularly learned counsel. So at this time, the court recognizes Mr. Justin Lascalzo, Esquire, for a motion.
May it please the court, I move the admission of McKenna H. Bonheim of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Hanson Shelby Cosby of the District of Columbia, Ryan Wagner Davis of the District of Columbia, Stephen Tad Ferry of the State of Maryland, Stephen Taylor Johnston of the State of Georgia, and Christine Lee Logan of the State of California. I have examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Lascalzo. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and your legal acumen. Therefore, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Mr. Lascalzo, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath. Counsel, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of this court. In doing so, I believe it's appropriate for me to recite the words that are inscribed over the door of the University of Virginia School of Law. Those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because you exemplify those ideals, it is indeed a privilege and an honor to have you as members of the bar of this court. Congratulations. You may be seated. Mr. Squires, do we have any other business before the court before we proceed to oral argument? Very well, then we shall proceed. Lieutenant Dempsey, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Tuosta, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Christopher Dempsey, and I represent the appellant, Private First Class Thomas Tapp. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. At the close of trial, the military judge, Lieutenant Colonel Norman, expressly declined to include the defense in an approximately 40-minute ex parte, quote, blasting of the trial counsel. He stated, when the trial counsel caps the sentence by asking for less than the maximum confinement, the defense have no incentive to avoid contested trials, and that there's then no price to be paid for their earlier decisions, such as taking the case to trial and filing motions. This court should reverse for two reasons. First, Lieutenant Colonel Norman was not impartial. And second, the effect this partiality had on appellant's case, military justice, and public perception of military justice is incalculable, warranting reversal.
So, counsel, I just want to make sure I understand the contours of your argument. Let's say, as part of a hypothetical, we've got a military judge who demonstrably and grievously fails to demonstrate the judicial temperament, the disinterestedness that we would expect to find in a military judge. Is it your position that that standing alone would so affect the appearance of bias that, regardless of an analysis of the Liljeburg factors, that appearance could never be cured?
No, Your Honor, and that's not quite the case here. While there are several comments that Lieutenant Colonel Norman makes on the record and ruling on motions and throughout the trial and even pretrial that indicate maybe he is frustrated with the defense and favors the government, that in and of itself does not rise to a level of partiality when taken by itself. It's really when paired with his post-trial comments that it becomes clear the bias that he harbored against the defense and the favoritism he held for the government that existed throughout the trial.
So when you say existed throughout the trial, is it your position we need to consider the totality of the circumstances here?
Yes, Your Honor. It's at least in assessing, especially apparent bias, it's how a reasonable observer would observe the proceedings, right? The totality of the proceedings.
So we've got a situation where this military judge was presented with a late file motion by the defense, and yet he did consider it.
He did consider it, Your Honor, but the commentary that surrounding that late filed motion is extremely questionable. For 25 pages of the transcript, he admonished the defense counsel. He threatened the two defense counsel who had not identified that motion earlier with censure, contempt, and reporting to state bars.
Did he do any of those things?
He did not do any of those things, but he did openly ask how they could promise to him that they had learned their lesson, and he asked them what consequences there would be for their actions in doing something like this.
Now, he was talking not about the substance of the motion. He was talking about the fact that it had been filed late.
It had been filed late, yes, Your Honor, under the trial management order, but not under the law. It was still 3 weeks before trial.
But this court recognizes that significant deference needs to be paid to a military judge in terms of his or her ability to run his or her own courtroom.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's why, as I stated earlier, those comments in and of themselves don't demonstrate partiality.
So where is the smoking gun? We also have a situation where there's focus on his comments during the ex parte proceeding where he's talking about the sentence that should be have been imposed or sought by trial counsel. But at the same time, in the course of the proceedings, he was concerned by the fact that defense counsel was not putting in a sufficiently robust sentencing argument. So if you're a member of the public and you're looking at this with the totality of the circumstances, even if you're feeling this particular military judge should not, in fact, be a military judge because of the concerns about disinterestedness and judicial temperament, where is that member of the public finding a specific sense that the accused, the appellant before us, was being negatively affected?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So in this court's precedent, United States versus Quintanilla, this court found that an ex parte communication, which might have the effect or give the appearance of granting an undue advantage to one party, cannot be condoned.
These comments were not being made from the panel. It was a panel who was deciding both the findings and the sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. It's the content of those comments, and specifically the second part of these comments. You know, him telling the trial counsel that they could have sought a more severe sentence and that their sentencing argument could have been stronger would not necessarily be problematic absent the ex parte nature of those comments. But it's the second part where he tells the government that not only was he angry with the defense for how they litigated the case, but that they should be angry too. And not only should they be angry, they should make the defense pay a price for that in the form of increased confinement. That establishes a chilling effect on a counsel's due process rights or an appellant's due process rights. If their counsel believe that they have a lawful motion that they need to file, they're going to have to think, this is going to get possibly an increased sentence for my client if he's found guilty.
So but let's counsel, tease that. I'm sorry.
No, go Chief.
Let's tease that out a little bit, though, because it goes to my first line of questioning in terms of, is it just a situation where the demeanor, the attitude, the approach that a military judge takes is so egregious that it results in any case going forward where there's going to be that public perception that there's unfairness, or does it have to be focused on this particular appellant in front of us?
Both, Your Honor. And are you talking about the Liljeburg factors, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. And looking at the Liljeburg factors, specifically that second and third factor, that's not specific to this case, right? The second factor is the risk of promoting injustice in other cases, and the third being the risk of undermining public confidence. Those comments are uniquely situated for both those second and third factors. He's telling the trial counsel in his circuit what he expects from them, that when the defense don't obey his court's instructions, that they should administer the rules through him by punishing the defense, making them pay a price in the form of increased confinement. That is a substantial risk of promoting injustice in other cases. And as this court held in United States versus Gredding, the fact that it would possibly prevent a substantive injustice in a future case should be enough to satisfy that factor.
Judge Johnson, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, Chief, you actually touched on what I was going to ask.
Counsel, may I ask you a legal question?
Yes, Your Honor.
To what extent does the Supreme Court's Leitke decision govern this case? I mean, it seems like the government relies very heavily on it, as opposed to Liljeburg. Is that case governing?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, it is. And I think it establishes it's a fairly lengthy opinion, Your Honor, but it establishes the rule that a military judge cannot show a deep-seated bias from one side or the other. And really what it establishes is there's not necessarily a requirement that bias comes from an extrajudicial influence. But defense's position, Your Honor, is that in this case he does demonstrate an extrajudicial bias against all defense counsel. And that's as demonstrated by, first, in that pretrial lecture where he spends 25 pages chastising the defense. For example, he is angry at the defense for having three detailed counsel. He says, what rule can you point me to that allows this appellant to have three counsel? But he never makes the same comment about the fact that the government also has three counsel.
But counsel, doesn't Leitke also stand for the proposition that rulings that fall within routine trial administration, implementation of court rules, even admonishments, do not rise to the level of disqualification? So if he's chastising them because they filed a motion late, that's squarely within that, routine trial administration efforts. So how are you distinguishing that?
Yes, and Leitke, Your Honor, that it would not ordinarily demonstrate bias in every case. But in this case, it augments those post-trial comments, those post-trial ex parte comments, and helps support that he was biased throughout the case and has that bias against defense counsel. Your Honor, to more directly answer your question, those comments in and of themselves don't establish the required appearance or actual bias under Leitke. But they're just a piece of the puzzle. And specifically when you link him seeking consequences for the trial defense counsel's action with him telling the government to make the trial defense counsel and thereby their appellant pay a price, it's clear when you bookend that those comments which bookend the trial demonstrate how he felt about how the defense litigated the case. And not only that, but that's a bias not just specific to defense counsel or appellant, but specific to the motions being filed in this case, the motions that he ruled on, which demonstrates the first Liljeburg factor is also met here, that there's a risk of injustice to the parties. There's only a requirement, to be clear, in my briefing it may not have been made clear, that Liljeburg only requires a risk of injustice to the particular parties, a risk. Appellant cannot point to a specific ruling that is an abuse of discretion. The Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals found at least one clearly erroneous finding in the findings of fact. But nonetheless, as this court found in United States versus McIlwain, every time the military judge ruled on evidence, asked questions, responded to members' questions, or determined instructions, he exercised his discretion. And because a military judge is charged with making a number of decisions, any one of which could affect the member's decision as to guilt or innocence or with regard to sentence, there was a risk of injustice. And that's what happened here. He ruled on at least two core critical case dispositive motions that would have undercut, or at least in part undercut, the government's theory of the case. That is a risk of a specific injustice against
the government. So it's this undefinable risk? It's not a situation where either the CCA or this court would look at it and say that the decision made by the military judge on that particular motion or motions was outside the range of reasonable choices before this military judge?
That could be the case, Your Honor. In the more recent opinion, United States versus Uribe, out of this court, the court looked at several factors, including whether the ruling exhibited a personal bias, uniformity of rulings, the strength of the government's case, if appellant challenged the rulings. In line with the same things that this court looked at in United States versus Uribe, the factors should be met here as well. They all favor appellant. Lieutenant Colonel Norman repeatedly stated that he believed this was a simple case and was frustrated with the defense in every one of his rulings. These are all, again, critical motions. The defense's theory of the case was handicapped by its inability to argue the facts that it wanted to introduce in those motions and the expert that they wanted to compel to testify.
So again, let's tease that out a little bit. Let's say that in a hypothetical case, three motions are filed and they're facially nonsense. Would you be then arguing, well, there were motions before the military judge, so there still was a risk?
No, Your Honor. And I believe this court found...
So why don't we have to look at the merits of the motion and determine that, in fact, the decision by the military judge was outside the range of reasonable choices before him?
Well, and this court should do so. In this case, if this court was to do so, while it's now law of the case and appellant cannot challenge the holdings of the lower court, the lower court did find at least one clearly erroneous finding of fact in the MRE 412 motion, which it dismissed as not being dispositive of the motion, but appellant would contend that it would have altered the trajectory and possibly changed the ruling. That is at least one example of where this wasn't just a cut-and-dry motion that could have gone one way, or definitely was a defense-favorable motion or a government-favorable motion, and the other side conceded. This was a contested motion with an erroneous finding.
But is it, Counsel, isn't it true, and that this is to piggyback on the Chief Judge's question, the trial judge also ruled against the government in motions. So it's not as if all government motions went through easily and all defense motions were denied. That is not the case. And so, and we're not sitting here doing it, as the Chief said, we're not doing this quantitative analysis. But if we were, it's like three on this side, two on that side. And so what are we then to make of the fact, based upon your argument, that the military judge did in fact rule against the government on some very important motions?
Your Honor, the motions that I'm discussing here were case dispositive. The motions that he ruled against the government were, you know, denying telephonic presence of a trial counsel at a motions hearing, and at least two instances of sustaining an objection calling for speculation. I concede that there are other instances where the military judge sided with the government, but nothing as significant as the motions where he ruled against the defense, Your Honor.
Okay. But again, how does that get us out of Leiteke, which says merely judicial rulings are not evidence of disqualification?
Absolutely.
I mean,
right.
That goes back to the Chief's point about if we're not looking at the merits of the motion and just the mere fact that he ruled against the defense, that even if it is case dispositive, you know, we are not to draw a conclusion based upon that, at least with regards to Leiteke.
Right. And with regard to Leiteke, Your Honor, when you look at his post-trial comments, where he says that the defense, when we're talking about specifically his bias infecting his rulings on motions, he tells the government that they should make the defense pay a price for filing those motions later out of time. It's unclear if Lieutenant Colonel Norman, during his deliberations and ruling on these motions on the record, sought to make the defense pay a price in his rulings as well. But because he tells the government to do so, it may be the case that he felt that he needed to do so as well. And that is the risk of specific injustice that's unique explicitly to this case, given the comments that Lieutenant Colonel Norman made.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sure you would love to be litigating this on a de novo posture, but that's not where we are, right? Like, what we're really doing is we're determining whether or not Colonel Woodward abused his discretion when he weighed the Lischberg factors. Is that right?
That's correct.
So if I go and I read his discussion of the three factors, what do you think he got wrong? Where was he unreasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. The biggest mistake that Colonel Woodard made, or the erroneous finding and conclusion that he made, which tied in the Lischberg factors, was that there was no actual or apparent bias in this case. He said that something to the effect of, while it was not an advisable thing to do to give this ex parte lecture, that it did not create an actual or apparent bias. And then he still conducted the Lischberg analysis, but through that lens, that there was no bias. That was erroneous. And specifically, he made several findings of fact that were erroneous, as outlined in my brief. The principal finding of fact that was erroneous in determining that there was no bias here was that Lieutenant Colonel Norman never stated or suggested that any accused, or specifically the accused in this case, Private First Class Tapp, should pay a price. Even Lieutenant Colonel Norman, in his unsworn statement, indicated that he told the trial counsel that they undervalued the case and that they failed to put a cap on sentencing. And all three trial counsel present that testified in the post-trial 39A on this issue explained that he did, in fact, state that they needed to pay a price and tied that price to the motions filing in this case. That was an erroneous finding of fact. Further, Your Honor, Colonel Woodard also improperly relied on Lieutenant Colonel Norman's unsworn statement, where over six pages of transcript, he repeatedly stated that he was impartial and omitted perhaps those two most egregious facts. He never admitted that he told the trial counsel that he was angry with the defense for filing motions or that they should be angry, and he never acknowledged that he told the trial counsel that they should make the defense pay a price for their actions in doing so. And that brings me to my final point in Liljeburg, Your Honor, which is that there's a risk of undermining public confidence in military justice if this case is not reversed. He sought to control the sentencing case of the government, not just his courtroom. And in evaluating this third factor, it's not limited just to the factors relevant to recusal, but also all of the proceedings. And Lieutenant or Colonel Woodard's, not only his post-trial 39A, but his conclusion in finding no bias and that the Liljeburg factors didn't require reversal, was really him sweeping it under the rug. And the NMCCA opinion did little to help with public confidence after the fact. His blasting aside, this case should be reversed based on Colonel Woodard's opinion, and I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. But this court should reverse.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Michael Tuosio. With Colonel Jennings, I represent the United States. Appellant was not denied his constitutional right to an impartial judge, and Colonel Woodard did not abuse his discretion in finding as such. Appellant has failed to overcome the strong presumption of judicial impartiality for two reasons. One, Lieutenant Colonel Norman did not display a deep-seated favoritism or antagonism that rendered fair judgment impossible. And two, there's no evidence of an extrajudicial bias that rendered fair judgment impossible.
Now, counsel, yes. We've got a military judge here who's just a bully. He starts being a bully right out of the blocks. It's not a situation where we just have to look at the ex parte communication that occurred later. We've got the military judge rattling his saber about a filing of a late motion and talking about whether it should be referred to the state bar and so forth. Then you've got the ex parte communications later that shows that this whole time that he was sitting in this case, about the negative view he had about this accused, and arguably that he had an extremely pro-government bias. If we're looking at the Liljeburg factors, doesn't it go to the point of how can the public, when they're looking at a situation like this, particularly in the military justice system, where, and the manner in which military judges are being appointed, that this cannot stand in terms of ensuring that the administration of justice is being meted out impartially?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll take the pretrial comments first related to the MRE 412 motion. A few points on that particular part of the record. So, one, I would note that the military judge was admonishing the counsel, not the appellant. And as mentioned before in Litke, the admonishments of the counsel does not itself rise to the level of judicial partiality that renders fair judgment impossible. He was admonishing trial counsel for raising a filing out of time. It's worth noting that the counsel at that time did not raise a disqualification motion when he was putting all of these opinions on the record, and that is an inference of impartiality that this court is permitted to make under Burton.
Now, in terms of admonishment, that's a little bit of an understatement. Certainly, I can see any military judge, any trial judge, being frustrated and admonishing counsel who would file a late motion, even though it's not late under the rules, late under the judge's own rules. But here, this military judge went on at length, didn't he? How many pages of the transcript?
Your Honor, the exact number of pages I don't have with me. It certainly was a strong admonishment, and I would reiterate that the motion.
So why wouldn't an accused sitting there, you're talking about the fact that if something is aimed at counsel rather than the accused, there seems to be this firm wall. If you're the accused sitting there and you're seeing your own counsel being blasted by the military judge, or you're a family member of the accused, or you're a member of the public watching this, how are you thinking over the course of this court-martial trial, oh, the military judge is disinterested, detached, neutral in terms of how he's going to handle this proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor, so you mentioned a member of the public. So the standard being a reasonable member of the public, would they find the judge was impartial? And it's worth noting here that this was a 39A that took place outside of the view of the members. So a reasonable member of the public would note that there was no motion to disqualify the judge at this moment, and none of this admonishment was taking place in front of the members. So the members, who ultimately were the sentencing authority here, rendering judgment on the appellant, were not privy to this judge's particular injudicious comments towards appellant defense counsel.
So is it the government's saving grace that it was the panel that was both the finder of fact and the sentencing agent in this case?
It is a strong factor, Your Honor, to consider under the Lilsberg factors and even the apparent bias analysis. It's clear in Lateke that it's possible for a military judge or any judge to show such a strong animosity towards defense counsel that judgment on behalf of the appellant, him or herself, becomes impossible. That's simply not what happened here, as evidenced by the fact that the military judge went out of his way here, Lieutenant Colonel Norman went out of his way to even put on the record that despite them filing the motion, MRE 412 motion at a time, to protect the rights of the appellant, he was going to rule on the motion on the merits.
So is it your position then that the government prevails on the Lilsberg factors, or do you think it never gets to that because there was no appearance of bias here?
Both, Your Honor.
If we've got a situation such as here where the ex parte dialogue occurs just with trial counsel and government counsel is so concerned about what that military judge just said and how it reflects on the bias of that military judge that the government counsel feels compelled to engage in the memorandum from record and turn it over to the defense. And it's not just a situation where this trial counsel alone is making that determination. He consults his superior, and they agree, ooh, this is so bad, we need to turn it over to the defense. How does the government possibly prevail on the notion that there's no appearance of bias when the government's representative in that courtroom seemed to think that there was?
Your Honor, the United States fully agrees with Colonel Woodard that the ex parte conversation was inappropriate. And with regards to ethical concerns, that's why the trial counsel provided the memorandum to the defense counsel. However, I would like to speak about the ex parte conversation with trial counsel now. And there are two points to be made. Under Quintanilla, the fact of the ex parte conversation is not itself disqualifying. And the substance of it is what we look to. The worry for an ex parte conversation at any stage of the trial is that an undue advantage was given to one party or the other. Now, here, the admonishment of trial counsel was with regards to their sentencing practice. It's worth noting here that Joint Appendix 1417, that the record supports that the military judge actually, Lieutenant Colonel Norman, actually advised defense counsel as well to provide a more robust sentencing case in this case, and he did that prior to sentencing. And the same exact topic was covered in this admittedly inappropriate ex parte conversation with trial counsel. So the same exact substance was actually discussed by Lieutenant Colonel Norman with both counsel. One could argue it was more impactful when he was advising defense counsel they should be putting on a more robust sentencing case. It just so happens that this conversation with trial counsel, where he's making similar statements related to his sentencing philosophy and pretrial negotiation philosophy, he's making these comments to trial counsel in an ex parte setting, which immediately is an ethical red flag. But as held in Quintanilla, it's the substance of the ex parte that we look to. And because of the memorandum, because of the court reporter's testimony, the trial counsel's testimony, we actually know exactly what was said in this ex parte conversation, and it does not give rise to an appearance of bias issue.
With respect to that conversation, isn't it a little concerning that the military judge turned down a request to do a post-trial debrief with all the counsel present? He specifically declined to do that, and then, after defense counsel had left, then he engages the trial counsel in this ex parte discussion. Doesn't that sort of suggest that he knew that this wasn't appropriate?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. It may suggest that he knew that ex parte conversations were, in general, inappropriate. The inappropriateness of the ex parte is just not dispositive, is what we're arguing.
Counsel, can I ask you, what is the relationship between Leitke and the Liljeburg factors?
Your Honor, Leitke speaks more towards our apparent bias analysis, because it makes clear in Quintanilla that the 455 alpha federal rules are similar to the RCMs in the military rules. So with regard to the Liljeburg factors, Your Honor, I think that's a separate analysis for prejudice. There might be some overlap in arguments, but the third Liljeburg factor, for example, is a little broader, as Colonel Woodard described in his holding, that we're looking to a general sense of what a reasonable person believes the entire military justice system is compromised, as opposed to whether a reasonable person would believe the military judge, him or herself, was impartial during the course of the trial.
Thank you. And second question, can you respond specifically to appellant's argument that Colonel Woodard abused his discretion by making a clearly erroneous finding of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I know what Tim Dempsey was referring to, and it was it's not disputed by the United States that there was an erroneous finding of fact. That's also found in the lower court with regards to a part of the MRE 412 motion that we can't get into, but that there was a clearly erroneous finding of fact found at the lower court level and not disputed by the United States. It had no impact on the ruling. There was no prejudice in that ruling.
Speaking of findings of fact, what are we to make of the fact that we're trying to figure out the standard review would be abuse of discretion, but here we've got a situation where Colonel Woodard is making a finding that, in fact, the military judge never stated that the trial counsel should have asked for more than 11 years of confinement. And yet what we've got is the trial counsel's memorandum for record, we have the assistant trial counsel, and we have the court reporter, who are all saying that he did do so, the military judge did do so. Then you've got a situation where the military judge refuses to testify, invoking the Fifth Amendment on a non-criminal matter, saying, I will not give any statements about what I said in this ex parte communication, court reporter present, as well as a number of trial counsel. And he's saying, I will not give a statement on that. And yet, the finding from Colonel Woodard is he never said that, even though the military judge won't discuss it, and everybody else who's present say, yes, the military judge did say that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat the exact finding that you're talking about that Colonel Woodard made?
That the military judge never stated that the trial counsel should have asked for more than 11 years of confinement.
Yes, Your Honor, so under the standard for abuse of discretion that the evidence doesn't support the finding, there was testimony by the trial counsel to support that particular finding. There was trial counsel that testified that he never asked for a specific sentence. So that testimony alone supports that finding. To the extent that this court is empowered to disagree or believe that an error was made, that falls under the abuse of discretion standard as well. But I would argue that it was supported by testimony on the record from one of the assistant trial counsel.
Counsel, can there be a fair hearing into whether the military judge was biased if the military judge refuses to testify?
You're talking about, Your Honor, the post-trial hearing?
Yes.
I think it was very fair that, starting with the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Norman recused himself, which he was actually not required to do, but he was under investigation and was being advised by counsel at that time.
Not under criminal investigation?
No, Your Honor, that's correct.
But regardless of whether it was fair to the military judge, the question is, can we just apply a simple abuse of discretion standard to Colonel Woodard's conclusion that there was no bias when Colonel Woodard was not able to speak with a potentially key witness on that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that a robust record was created, but because of the hearing and the testimony and the memorandum, it is certainly a factor to be weighed that Colonel Norman himself wasn't being assessed by Colonel Woodard. But it's just one factor in what is otherwise a robust post-trial hearing. And in juxtaposed to Quintanilla, where the problem there, this Court found, was that we just didn't know what happened during the ex parte at all. And it was that, in that case, it was actually remanded for further investigation. Here, we had testimony from the assistant trial counsel, the court reporter, and there's a lot for Colonel Woodard to rule on.
Lieutenant Torosto, I'm curious, and you may or may not know this, and I don't remember to tell you the truth, but was Colonel Woodard from outside the circuit, or was he a member of the judicial circuit in which this case was tried? That's okay if you don't know.
I can't speak definitively to that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
All right. And let me ask you one other question here. I'm also trusting that your research skills are more refined than mine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And that said, have you come across any case in the federal system where a district court judge may have acted close to this kind of conduct or similar to this conduct?
Your Honor, actually, appellant cited, and then the government cited, Eduardo Franco, and it's a Second Circuit case. And the reason I agree that that was on point is because there was an extrajudicial source of bias found. In particular, this was a much more egregious form. It was a form of racism by the judge on the record indicating that he had prejudice towards Colombians, and the appellant in that case happened to be Colombian. The reason it was so on point is that in that case, the court actually did go find that that was unacceptable, but did go back and then retroactively analyze some of the things that the Supreme Court tells us to analyze in Liddicke, such as the rulings. And so in that case, what they were looking for, what they found was that the rulings in that case were very unusual, not just adverse to the appellant in that case, which is not in and of itself proof of anything as found in Uribe, but they found that the military judge was ruling sua sponte in the government's favor. They were ruling the judge was ruling in the government's favor
I'm thinking more along the lines of the post-trial comments and conduct of this military judge. In other words, taking on the supervisory role of the government counsel, almost giving what appears to be what advice that the government counsel's supervisor or boss would give him. Why is the military judge engaged in that kind of conduct? And I don't know if that was the case in the case you just mentioned. I think in that case, they were talking about what was going on during the trial. But I guess I'm wondering, have you come across anything where there's a post-trial or information that arises afterwards that shows conduct on the part of the trial judge that might require us to go back and view his decisions maybe in a different light.
Yes, Your Honor. So there are two lower court cases included in the briefs, U.S. v. Kish and U.S. v. Bremer, where these are cases that are similar. If you put aside the fact that it's an ex parte conversation, the lower court has analyzed when what they found to be injudicious comments are made outside of the courtroom and there becomes there's evidence of it, then the court can either, or has, the lower court has either went back and reviewed United States v. Kish. They found that the military judge in that case, there was clear evidence of him taking the role of a hard-charging prosecutor by asking over 200 questions on behalf of the trial counsel. And in U.S. v. Bremer, there was not much of a record to analyze, so they applied a remedy post-injudicious comments, but these injudicious comments were made outside of the trial context.
Right, but those cases weren't quite like what we see here in the ex parte nature of what happened immediately after the trial in the absence of the defense counsel. This is, I mean, you have to admit, fairly unusual, to use your term, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor. And I see I'm running out of time, if you don't mind, Chief.
Please respond.
There's no case exactly on point where there's an ex parte conversation with trial counsel where these injudicious comments are being made. That's why we relied mostly on comments being made just outside of the trial context in different parts chronologically of the stages of the trial. I would say that it's important to go back and look at Lieutenant Colonel Norman's actions during the trial and distinguish them from comments being made that might indicate that he's prosecutorial-minded. And here, there's just no evidence during the course of the trial that took place.
Thank you.
Chief, it's a follow-up because that's actually what I wanted to ask. So it's the government's position that there is no evidence of extrajudicial bias here?
Your Honor, the government concedes that the comments made on the record by Colonel Norman about the defense office indicate an extrajudicial source of knowledge, for example, that Colonel Norman was bringing into the case. That is not disputed. But what is disputed, it is not analogous at all to the cases that we presented in our brief, Eduardo Franco being one, Patecki, Greeting, and McElwain, of the type of extrajudicial bias that weighs heavily against the government. In Eduardo Franco and Patecki, there are examples of actual prejudice towards the ethnic background of the appellant. In Greeting and McElwain, we're looking at military judges bringing to the trial knowledge from a companion case and that being made clear to the parties prior to that military judge in each respective case presiding over the trial. And those were examples of extrajudicial biases that gave rise to an appearance of bias in those particular cases. And it's worth noting again that in Latecki, this is a factor to be considered. Still, the ultimate question is, was fair judgment rendered impossible? And within that very monologue that Lieutenant Colonel Norman gives in the 39A, he proves dispositively that fair judgment was not impossible. Because after admonishing defense counsel, he, for the sake of the appellant's constitutional rights, rules on the motion on the merits.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Dempsey, you reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's rare to have insight into what a bully judge like Lieutenant Colonel Norman thinks, and that is why there is no directly on par case law with what we have here. This lecture was not about the sentencing guidelines or how to be a better prosecutor. It was about punishing the defense for not following the orders that he wanted. This court should send a message under Lilsberg 2 to the military justice community and prevent further injustice in future cases by doing so, that this is not acceptable. And under the third Lilsberg factor, public confidence, when you look at the entire proceedings, again, both Colonel Woodard and the NMCCA protected Lieutenant Colonel Norman from testifying without even an analysis on the issue. And then the NMCCA went even further in their opinion, by almost alleging an ethical allegation against the defense counsel for even challenging this issue. The lower court in United States versus Bremer, which we just discussed, dismissed or reversed the findings based on the third Liljeburg factor only. At a minimum, the court should do that here as well. Thank you.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25.